I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.
Hi there, I'm Lale Arakoglu, and I'm really excited that today I'm talking to film director Lulu Wang. She's featured in Condé Nast Traveler's Women Who Travel Power List, published today. It's a celebration of the women who are shaping the way we travel in 2024 and beyond, including television hosts, chefs, designers, activists, and filmmakers. Lulu is the creator of Expats, an Amazon original drama series starring Nicole Kidman. It's shot on location in Hong Kong.
Don't you ever miss it? Home?
I like our life here. The help the drivers, it makes everything easier.
Expat is an intersection of three American women and many other people around them who are all affected by one event, one life-changing tragedy that ripples throughout this community. And Expats looks at issues of privilege and power dynamics, race, class, the intersection of so many different identities, and how this tragedy affects all of them.
The word expatriate suggests moving to a foreign country for well-paid work and choosing to live in a bubble of an expat community. Think lounging on recliners in self-segregated country clubs. But who gets to call themselves an expat? The differences in the word expat and the word immigrant are very telling.
I wanted to explore the thorniness and the prejudices and the biases that we have.
What's your relationship to the word expat?
You know, I think it's thorny in a way, in the same way as being American abroad sometimes, you know. I think that there are connotations that come with it that invoke a sort of carelessness, a kind of like non-integration or respect for the culture.
You were born in China and then you moved to the States. So what was that journey for you?
My parents brought me to the U.S., to Miami specifically, when I was 6 years old. And it was during a time where there was a lot of political turmoil in the country. And there was a lot of uncertainty about the future of the country. And, you know, we boarded a plane, my mother and I, to join my father, who left a few months before us and didn't know if we were going to get our visas. And we were so lucky that we did and left. And we had a connecting flight in Paris, in Charles de Gaulle. And it was just terrifying because, you know, and now I travel all the time and I have no fears. And even if I don't speak French perfectly, I can get by.
You know, you said you travel lots now, but that's for work and out of choice. And that journey was out of necessity.
Yeah, absolutely. It is by choice and it's temporary. But I think more than that, and this is something I think about a lot, which is like trying to really understand what it is to be traveling the world as an American in 2023, 2024, versus being Chinese and traveling in 1989, where you've never left the country. There's not a ton of access to other cultures. It's not like now we see places and we could somehow have a sense of what it is that's out there. Back then, it wasn't like that at all. And I think there's also a confidence that we have as Westerners that you can go anywhere in the world and kind of be fine. Like, you could be a little nervous, but oftentimes I think that's a false confidence. It's a naivete, it's a arrogance perhaps. But still, you feel like you can land anywhere and land on your feet. My mom did not feel that way as a 36-year-old Chinese woman who had never left the country, didn't speak a word of English, and just suddenly put on a plane and didn't know anything. Hong Kong being a central character in this series was essential for the series and also for me to be interested in making it. I think there's not just an intersection of East and West, old world, new world, but it's really an intersection of so many different identities, different classes, different races, genders. I wanted to explore that intersection, the conflicts that come with it, but the communities and friendships that are also built out of these intersections.
The three lead roles of the show are all women, and they're all different kinds of expats. And privilege is obviously explored within that.
Margaret is just incredibly privileged, is a mother of three kids, but she's struggling with her own sense of identity because she has given up her career to follow her husband because he makes more money and to give this experience to her family.
I just sometimes want to be alone, where I'm not somebody's wife, not somebody's mother, where I'm not defined by tragedy.
Nicole Kidman plays American expat Margaret, married to an executive, Clark Wu. They live in a luxury condo with panoramic views of Hong Kong Harbour in the ritzy Peak District. The springboard for the script is the best-selling novel, The Expatriates, by Janice K. Lee. Lulu Wang added story elements and some significant changes.
The character that we took the most liberties with from the book is the character of Hillary, a white British woman. And in the show, we made her Indian American.
I think my marriage is over.
Has David been home?
No, ma'am.
What am I still doing?
I think that they are each so specific and so different from each other, which is what I loved. And yet they're forced to be connected for various reasons. Like Mercy is an expat, but she's Korean American, so she gets confused as being local, even though she doesn't speak not only Cantonese, she doesn't really even speak Korean. She's a New Yorker. And she's also broke. She doesn't come from money. She's there on her own without family. She kind of followed her rich friends that she went to school with at Columbia in New York. And she has to figure out now how to live here.
Not a moment goes by where I'm not thinking about what I've done. People like me, do they ever move on?
Janice K. Lee's book was optioned by Nicole Kidman. From what I understand, when she approached you to direct it, you initially turned it down. What gave you that trepidation before finally accepting?
I think the hesitation came from sort of an internal question for me. I think so often in the industry, somebody makes a film, a project that's a hit, and then people want to snatch you up and put you in an environment where you're making, you know, a big studio movie. And then you don't really get the full creative control there. And if it works or it fails, you're not quite sure if it's because of you, if it was your voice. And I wasn't sure that we would have that on Expats, but after talking with Nicole about my hesitations and also my desires and what I would want to do with this novel as an adaptation, she was so supportive and felt like that was exactly the kind of vision, and having a visionary behind it was exactly what she wanted. I think that I needed to make something that was truly mine and in my voice in order to know if I was cut out for the industry. And that if I didn't make it, it was because I had given it everything that I had and it still didn't work. I had to make sure that Expats was done on my terms. The more that you are in your power, the more that you trust yourself and your voice and you go against the grain and you challenge the status quo, the more fearless you are. And that's really powerful. And so it's something that I'm continuing to learn.
After the break, Lulu's remarkable fifth episode of Expats, where she shifts focus.
Hi, I'm Deborah Treisman, fiction editor of The New Yorker and host of the New Yorker Fiction Podcast. On the podcast, I ask a great contemporary writer to select a favorite story from the magazine's almost 100-year archive to read and discuss. Together, we delve into the story, exploring its themes, its style, and what makes fiction work. You can listen to authors like Otessa Moshfegh talk about why we write.
Story, or attaching a story or creating a story, is this inclination that we all have to stop spinning.
And you can hear writers like George Saunders discuss the nature of storytelling.
On the first read, you accept these things as descriptions and they make you see the scene, but every line is a chance to inflect the reader's mind.
You'll discover new favorite authors and read old favorites in new ways. Episodes of the New Yorker Fiction Podcast are released on the first of every month. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Have you ever owned something that inspired you to level up? For me, it's my hiking boots, which have gotten me over some pretty tough terrain. And I'm not talking about my morning commute on the New York City subway. They've pushed me to go to far-off places like trekking in the remote mountains in Patagonia, wildlife spotting amid the thick rainforests of the Amazon, and climbing through canyons in the Utah desert. When we own exceptional things, they inspire us to do exceptional things. The all-new Lexus GX has an exceptional capability that will have you seeing possibilities you never knew existed. There's an available panorama glass roof, 33-inch all-terrain tires, and multi-terrain select driving modes. Its advanced technology and luxurious interior means that wherever you go, you'll never go without. Live up to the all-new Lexus GX. Luxury beyond limits. Experience amazing at your Lexus dealer. This message comes from Apple Card. Earn up to 3% daily cash back on every purchase, every day. Then, grow it at 4.50% annual percentage yield when you open a savings account with Apple Card. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card subject to credit approval. Savings available to Apple Card owners, subject to eligibility. Savings accounts provided by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, member FDIC. Terms apply. In the remarkable fifth episode of Expats, the domestic workers, who until this point are depicted in smaller roles, get to tell their stories.
These women have left their own families to provide full-time work and send money back home. And it's something that, you know, I as an immigrant recognize, because that's something that my parents did. And that's something so many people in California, New York, and everywhere, right?
Episode 5, which is a feature-length film, essentially, that sits within this show, is dedicated to the caretakers or service workers of Hong Kong. How did you go about making a feature-length episode within the show? What were the challenges of doing that? And why did it feel important to give so much time to those stories in one episode?
I think because I only got one episode to do that, you know, and I wanted to make sure that even though it was one episode out of six, that it had the scope and the weight that it needed to have, and the importance. That's why it's called Central. they are central to this whole story. There's a large population of workers that are women, and they come from all over Southeast Asia, the Philippines, Malaysia, Indonesia. And we focused on two Filipino women, but they do. There is a larger population than just the Philippines.
Alam nating lahat ang tungkol sa employer natin. Mga sekreto na kahit pinakamalapit na kaibigan niya ay hindi alam.
I've been thinking a lot about how so much of travel and hospitality is about invisible work. It's the person who cleans your room. It's the person who hangs your robe up when you're out. It's the person who leaves cold water on your nightstand. And it never gets discussed really, or to have a light shone on it, or to tell the stories of the people who are doing that.
I think that caretaking is something that domestic labor is something that is very rarely shown. And I just knew that I couldn't make a show about women in Hong Kong without telling the story of at least some of the hundreds of thousands of women that are on the streets of Hong Kong every Sunday. Every Sunday.
The title of this episode, Central, also refers to Hong Kong Island's central business district, filled with parks and public spaces where maids meet on their day off.
It is known as Maids Picnic. That's what they call it. And it is the day that all of these women have off from work, and they are expected to not be in the house because their employers want to have that day to be with their families and not have the help, like, be there. And so, you know, it's a day where they get to be with their friends and they get to go out. But sometimes it's raining and there's a typhoon or there's storms, and they still have to find a way to not be in the house. If you visit Hong Kong, you see these women on Sundays on cardboard boxes, under overpasses and bridges and footbridges, if it's raining, you know. And if it's not, then they're out, you know, in parks, and they play cards and they're singing and there's dancing, and people bring boom boxes and there's tents and umbrellas to, you know, hide from the elements. And it feels in many ways like a big festival. It is just a breathtaking visual to take in because it's so joyous, and yet the circumstances are quite sad. And I think I just wanted to capture that sense of community and friendship between women in that environment and their resilience as well.
Do you think that filmmaking has a unique ability to allow someone to see themselves in a different way, to see that reverse perspective of their role in society?
100%. I always feel that every frame is political, like who you center in a frame, you know, the lens that you shoot someone with or something with, right? It's a statement. It's a point of view. How can it not be? You're constantly making these choices with every single frame. Often the writers in the writer's room and I, we would identify with different perspectives and we would debate them. And so then I would say, like, let's put these debates on the page. Like, let's give these perspectives to these three women, or to even beyond that, the men, the other characters, to see tensions.
The writer's room was predominantly made up of women, right?
I didn't set out to be like, I want an all women's writer's room. I set out to say, what are the perspectives that are going to help enhance the story in perspectives that I'm not as familiar with? And so I just started thinking about writers and meeting with different people. It just turned out that the women that I met with had so much to say about these characters, and they brought a perspective that was eye-opening that I had never seen before represented on screen. And so it was just clear that these were the people that were best for the job.
Coming up, making a film, The Farewell, that became a runaway success, and traveling to Lulu's grandmother's home in China.
I'm Alex Schwartz.
I'm Nomi Fry.
I'm Vincent Cunningham, and this is Critics at Large, a New Yorker podcast for the culturally curious.
Each week, we're going to talk about a big idea that's showing up across the cultural landscape, and we'll trace it through all the mediums we love. Books, movies, television, music, art.
And I always want to talk about celebrity gossip, too.
Of course.
What are you guys excited to cover in the next few months?
There's a new translation of The Iliad that's coming out, Emily Wilson.
Oh.
Really excited to see whether I can read The Iliad again, whether I'm that literate. The jury is out.
I can't wait to hear Adam Driver go again in an Italian accent in Michael Mann's Ferrari.
He can't stop.
I mean, and bless him. I can't wait.
Molto bene.
Molto bene.
We hope you'll join us for new episodes each Thursday. Follow Critics at Large today, wherever you get podcasts.
You really don't want to miss this.
Don't.
Don't miss this.
Don't miss it.
See you soon.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.
Lulu Wang's The Farewell is based on her family's decision in 2013 to shield her grandmother from tragic news and devise an elaborate ruse that's both poignant and darkly comic. Lulu and her crew flew to her grandmother's hometown, Changchun, in northeast China.
It felt surreal. Like, in what world would I come back to China, like, you know, 30 years later and come back as a American film director and have my grandma get to witness that. The Farewell is about a young American woman who returns to China when she learns that her grandmother has a terminal cancer. And her family tells her that they are not going to reveal this diagnosis to her grandmother, even though the doctors have given her only 3 months to live. And instead, they're going to put on a wedding for her cousin and sort of a faux wedding as an excuse to all gather, to unite so that they can all say goodbye to her grandmother without her grandmother knowing. And her grandmother just thinks everyone's there for a wedding.
I loved The Farewell, and it was, you know, so lauded and, you know, ended up with a Golden Globe win for Awkwafina. What did making The Farewell mean to you and to those who worked on it?
It was a feeling that I've always, like, hoped for and dreamed of, which is to bring together all of my different worlds, you know, to, rather than stepping into my parents' world, which I'll never be able to fully do authentically, or stepping into the world of my Western friends, that I wanted to be in a world where there was an intersection of both, of my own passions that came fully from me, friends and collaborators that I love, and my family.
Funding for The Farewell, which features an all-Asian cast, was a struggle. Then, Lulu told her story in an episode of This American Life called What You Don't Know. The podcast drew the attention of a producer who helped secure the finance. 70% of the film is in Mandarin.
I think growing up as an immigrant, I've always felt that these were separate worlds. And with The Farewell, I got to bring them all together. And it felt very whole making that film, of having these people who've never even been to China be in my grandmother's house, you know, having dinner with her, and then creating that space in on our set. And, you know, my production designer was in my grandmother's house and we were all having dinner in her little apartment. And she was just going from room to room collecting things. And like, we were like, young, like, come eat. Like, what are you doing? And she was like, this is perfect. I need all these props. And my grandma was like, what is she doing?
I was going to say, how did your grandma feel about that?
No, she was like, what? She was like, of course, anything for you. But then later she was like, she's going to bring it back, right? Like, I only have one copy of that picture and it means a lot to me. Is she going to bring it back? You know, photos of my dad and my uncles as kids that were framed and just all kinds of things. And so there's just a lot of funny things like that, that is just ridiculous. As I was touring with The Farewell, so many people came up to me and said, I'm from Egypt, I'm from the Middle East, I'm from South America. We did this to my grandmother, my grandfather, you know. And I was pretty surprised because I had no idea. Beijing and Shanghai, I think, are filled with a lot more Westerners. There are a lot more expats. Changchun was traditionally a more like an agricultural city. It has a huge population, so I wouldn't say that it's necessarily small, but it's just not. It's very, very north of China, and it's not as westernized as Beijing or Shanghai, and it's there's not as much Western business, so it's just less visited by Westerners. And I think there used to be a lot of like car manufacturing. So I think the only people that would go there would be a lot of like German car manufacturing companies. So it's not a popular like tourist destination, basically. In Changchun, I think that like the rest of the country, there's a lot of communist architecture. There's also just a lot of new developments. There's a ton of apartment buildings, very high apartment buildings that are clustered together. And there's a uniformity to them. They're all the same color. And much of it looks the same throughout the city and even throughout the country, like a lot of this new development of condos. And it's also very cold there during the winter, so it's covered in snow. And during the summer, it gets incredibly hot. And so everyone in the film was sweating all the time.
I've been thinking a lot about this quote I read from you in a recent interview you did with The Guardian, where you said, I've always created my whole life from a space of nobody wants to see this, nobody cares. What does it feel like now to be making work that is being seen? Or do you feel like it's being seen?
It can be kind of scary because you have to reorient yourself of like, how do I know what to make? Like, I barely even got used to, oh, the things that I, you know, coming, like working from a place of like just small, hidden, nobody's watching. Like I barely even got, and then having it work, like I'm barely starting to even get used to that. And now I don't know. I think there is a sense of pressure of like, oh, there's, I mean, before I think that my pressure was my family and myself, you know, I give myself a lot of expectations. And now, you know, you feel like, oh gosh, there's like other expectations. I think that it's just this constant reminder to shut out the noise, even if the voices have gotten louder or there's a larger group of them, and that you still have to continue to go back into your tiny space and create from a place of like quiet.
Lulu formed a tight-knit crew to make her indie feature The Farewell, and they were reunited for Amazon's Expats.
I think that if something works, you know, you don't change it. If it's not broke, don't fix it, right? I mean, I just love them. The farewell wouldn't exist. My career wouldn't exist without them. It was such a true and wonderful collaboration that I wouldn't be the filmmaker that I am without them, truly. It's not this like myth of the auteur, you know. Filmmaking is a collaborative medium.
Lulu, this has been such a great chat. Thank you so much. You can stream all 6 episodes of Expats on Amazon now. Next week, How We Made the Power List, where I chat with senior editor Megan Spurrell about how we chose this year's most powerful women shaping the travel space. I'm Lale Arikoglu, and you can find me on Instagram at Lale Hannah. Our engineers are Jake Loomis, Nick Pittman, and James Yost. The show's mixed by Amar Lal. Jude Kampfner from Corporation for Independent Media is our producer. Chris Bannon is Condé Nast's head of global audio. See you next week.
The Run Through with Vogue is where you'll meet all the most exciting people in fashion and culture.
I am Fran Lebowitz, who should be the mayor of New York.
We all support that. We support that.
Very nice.
Nikki.
Yes.
It's been really great being in this beautiful pink room.
All right, Usher, can you hear us?
I can hear you.
All right.
Can you hear me?
We can.
We can.
All right, here we are.
On the podcast, you'll learn how Vogue really works.
Sometimes we'll come in for a second or even third run through until we are AWOK.
Can you tell us what AWOK means?
It means AWOK, Anna Wintour OK.
I'm Cho Minardi.
And I'm Chloe Mel.
And we're the hosts of The Run Through with Vogue, where fashion and culture collide.
Join us. It's AWOK.
Listen and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.